Welcome to the Andy Staples Show, presented by Sling. We have a very special guest today, and not just because he's been nice enough not to highlight me on his feed very often. Fred Siegel, the man behind the Old Takes Exposed, Freezing Cold Takes Twitter feed. He's got a book out now, Freezing Cold Takes the NFL. And Fred, this is just marvelous. Just unbelievable, because your feed is incredible, because you call out all these hot take artists who just believe so strongly in something that is completely idiotic. But now you've gone back into history and found some of the worst takes in the world.
Yeah, this was the most fun thing I've done with the feed, because I was able, I mean, that has a relation to the feed. It's not an extension of the feed. It's just because I was able to do research. I have a lawyer background. I was a lawyer for 8 years. I used to research a lot of things I did not enjoy researching, but I enjoyed researching. And this was just like the greatest time researching for me. And I just, it was something that I had enjoyed doing pretty much the whole time I was doing it. It took me 2 years.
I'm just laughing my butt off as I'm reading it. Like, people ripping the Patriots hiring Bill Belichick as the head coach, people ripping the Packers signing Reggie White. Like, there's a bunch of who needs Reggie White takes out there.
Yeah. I mean, Reggie White was going to sign a huge contract. He was the first free agent, like the first unrestricted free agent the NFL ever had, like the big one. He went on a tour, like a 12-team tour, where they all lavished him with gifts. And unlike college football, they were allowed to discuss what gifts he got.
Yeah,
his wife got mink coats. No one could understand why you'd pay that much money to one player. And it wasn't even that much money compared to now.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And then obviously his Packers career bore out why he was paid that. But that's true. I mean, the Eagles themselves thought that he was kind of washed up relative to what he was asking for. So
exactly.
It's incredible. I had not thought about some of these situations. Like, the one, your second chapter is all about people wanting Dan Marino traded so that Scott Mitchell could start for the Dolphins. And I remember that as a kid. I was a Dolphins fan growing up. We lived in the Keys for 4 years when I was in elementary school. I was in Orlando at the time all of this was going on. So, like, I remember that vividly, but I had forgotten the drumbeat for Scott Mitchell as the Dolphins starter.
Well, the funny thing, that's an interesting highlight, because I grew up in North Miami. I grew up about 10 minutes from the stadium. I was a Dolphins season ticket holder. I remember it completely. That's how I knew about that take. I probably wouldn't have been able to thought about it to write about it if I didn't know about it. We talked about it for years. But at the time, you know, Dan Marino got hurt. It was the first time he was ever hurt for a long period. It was his 10th season. He tore his Achilles. Scott Mitchell came in. He was the backup quarterback. And he had three great games. And it wasn't that big of a drumbeat amongst the fans. It was one guy, Greg Cody, from the Miami Herald. He wrote the article.
Who's a podcasting star now with the Dan Levitard Show.
He had me on his podcast to talk about that a couple weeks ago, to talk about this particular thing. I talked to him about it for the book. He's interviewed in the book. But he's the one who brought it up. But at the time, it was such a big deal that he did that. Now, if Scott Mitchell would have done the same thing in this time period, there would have been at least four tweets about trading Marino to keep Scott Mitchell, and Stephen A. Smith and Nick Wright would all be discussing it on Monday morning on their show.
Oh, it's the A block of...
It would just fly through. 2 days later, no one would remember it. But this was such a big deal when he did that. It never happened.
It is amazing. But now, I've known you for a while, and I know that your true passion is college football. So I am ready for the college football book. I will give you a freebie, because this is and I actually every time I see one of your tweets, I think, thank God he had not started doing this feed when this came out, because this would have been so. Here we go. The prediction cover of Sports Illustrated heading into the Oregon Ohio State national title game. Ducks 45, Bucks 41, why Oregon will own the first playoff by Andy Staples. So here's the backstory on this. They didn't want a big story leading into the game because of the production schedule. There was a really meaty Gronk feature that Pete Thamel had written that was going. There was a John Elway story. And so I did some kind of capsule stuff that was going to run in the magazine, and we left the meteor stuff on the website. And like right, I think it was Sunday, and they kind of closed things on Monday. I get an email saying, hey, we need a score prediction from you for the national title game. And like, I don't really feel that strongly about this. I don't know. I just watched Oregon kick the crap out of Florida State in the Rose Bowl. Maybe Ohio State, you know, they're still playing their third string guy. Oregon's got the Heisman Trophy winner. Okay, I'm going to go with Oregon for this, but I'm going to make it close because I don't feel very strongly about this. That got thrown back in my face during and after that game so many times.
By all the coaches?
By the fans. I had no idea. I thought they were going to put it inside, just in these capsules in the magazine. They put it on the freaking cover of Sports Illustrated. Like, the cover comes out, I'm like, what have you done?
Did you even write about it did you write a column on it in the magazine?
Not in the magazine, because I had to do the game story off the national title game. So that was a reported feature on Ohio State.
Just your email to the editor saying 45-41. That was the cover.
Yes, that was it. And I'm like, why did you put that on the cover? What are you doing
with your name?
But yeah. Now, and then I'll give you another one, because this is one that I know you had a field day with last year. But because you've created a cottage industry under yourselves, now the teams want to piggyback on it. So
They like to do to bring attention to their feed.
Yes, this show made the Alabama pregame hype video before the SEC title game.
Alabama hasn't been this big an underdog in 13 years. I got to tell you, the tide is about to roll right into a big old brick wall.
I expect to see Georgia whip Alabama, because I don't think Alabama's that good.
I'm worried about Alabama scoring.
The matchup is as bad for Alabama as you could possibly imagine. I think Georgia wins. I think Georgia wins by double digits, and I honestly don't even think it's going to be very competitive.
They're not going to beat Georgia.
Well, you guys nailed it. For the national
game. Well, what's funny is I went back on that, because me and Ari did a bit after that, actually on that night, where I made us swear that we would never pick against Nick Saban again.
Oh yeah, is that what I posted?
No, I think you probably posted that, because then Ari went back on it and picked Georgia in the national title game. And then I didn't. I picked Alabama because I was keeping my pledge, even though I had predicted Georgia preseason to win the national title. I did think Georgia was going to win, but I wasn't going against my word again after I got burned.
It was like, but I don't understand how everyone was writing Georgia off after that game.
I did a story.
Heavily favored over Michigan, and they were going to play Alabama again. And I don't understand why it was so obvious that they would win it. Automatically, Alabama would win again.
And then if you watch, like I did a story on Georgia's defense going into the national title game, and I rewatched their defense against Alabama and their defense against Michigan, and then watched what some of the other teams had done to beat Alabama. I was like, oh, Georgia was just playing vanilla in the first game, just in case they didn't need to show anything, and they're gonna bring out the whole bag of tricks. In the national, and they did
right. They were the better team. It was clear, and even it was like for the first half of that game, it looked like the SEC game. It looked like they were the better team.
Yeah,
it was really only two quarters that Alabama outplayed them.
Yeah, and that's the thing. But these things live forever. And I thought I appreciate that Alabama thought of me enough to put me in there with Skip Bayless. On the hype video. So,
well, whatever. Yeah, that's a good one, because I mean, do you have these clips on your feed of you, or was that from Feinbaum or something?
That was Alabama's pregame hype video.
Your clip
That they showed. Oh yeah, yeah. And we've got that clip on the feed, and we did. You know,
usually they're easy to find. Like you'll find they'll post. Fox Sports 1 will post that Bayless clip like 3 times a day when he said it. Yeah. So it's easy to find. That's the ones that they're picking to use for the clip.
Well,
the one with Barrett was definitely all over CBS Sports.
Oh, yeah. Well, I want to ask you about that because as you've evolved with the feed, you've been very clear that you're not going to just or you're rationing yourself on certain people.
Oh, yeah.
Because their jobs are hot takes. And they don't always believe what they're saying. Like, how do you figure out, okay, this is a person I need to highlight? Because it feels like it's when they truly believe it that right. It makes it funny.
Well, I feel like, okay, one of the things that I try not to flame, occasionally if it's really funny, I'll do it. Or if the person was being so obnoxious that I don't care about how they feel about retweeting it, I don't really use fans. Like, I don't want them right. to get browbeat. But if the person has a blue check, that means that they are someone I feel that has put themselves in a position where they should be able to have ability to withstand this type or should expect it.
In yes. some way.
So that right there, if you have a blue check, I could use your stuff no matter what. I don't care what you're in. Now, I mean, I have a strict no politics rule, but it's about the subject matter. I would be happy to use politicians if their tweet was solely about the sport or a prediction. So like any politician, anybody like that, I'll use no matter what. But guys on TV who really want attention, I'm not going to use them all the time, even though I get tagged to them and endlessly because it's just like you're giving them exactly what they want. Plus, there's a genuine factor there. Like, you want them to be at least somewhat genuine with what they're doing. And I understand TV and radio, and I understand that you have to talk about the big topics, and you have to, even if you genuinely believe something, you have to say it in a way, and maybe in a way where you've enhanced your opinion a little bit just to make it sound interesting so people will listen to you. And I get that. But there's some people who do it solely because their predictions are based on what will get reaction, nothing of what they believe.
Right. And I feel like you can usually tell. And like the me predicting Georgia to beat Alabama in the SEC, I believe that wholeheartedly. Like there was no
right
showmanship there. Because if we had, I would have picked one side and Ari would have picked the other and we would argue about it. But we both believe that Georgia would win. So that's what we went with.
Right.
And yeah. It's just amazing. Now, I've also created a rule for myself because of you. You know, most people have a never tweet when you're drinking rule, which I think is a very, very sound policy. But I have a never tweet in the first quarter rule because of you.
Very good rule. The first quarter, I in a big game, I always highlight. I mean, the bookmark in the first quarter. If a team goes up 14-0, I immediately start bookmarking anything on my feed that. It's just like my first instinct about anything. Even if the team looks like they're going to blow them out, I still do it anyway. The first quarter is a great part, especially for a team that's universally great and expected to win. A good example of that is, or maybe first half rule, was Alabama 2014 playoff against Ohio State.
Oh, yeah.
21-10 or 21-3. There was a touchdown to go up 21-3, and immediately there was the – or especially when you're playing against Urban Meyer, you get the pizza post, the hospital automatically, and spend time with family. like quotes about Urban Meyer. That one was one of those ones that you just like immediately. It's like that Alabama's outmatched, Ohio State's outmatched. You know, it's that type of thing.
And of course, we know what happens. Ezekiel Elliott runs wild in the second half, and it is. I do love the confidence that some people come out with in the first. The basketball title game this year was a prime example. There was no way Kansas was coming back.
That was a great one. Basketball title game was a perfect bookmark game. And also at the time, the Baylor game was starting to be a bookmark game. But it was a bookmark at the end of that. Baylor came back against North Carolina. Mm-hmm. North Carolina lost their best player. Like he got kicked out of the game or fouled out or ejected. And Baylor came back. And then when it got to overtime, right before overtime, 10,000 tweets about how North Carolina will never come back.
We'll be right back after this message from one of our lovely sponsors. What has been your, other than that Alabama-Ohio State game, what has been your favorite college football game in terms of the takes?
There's some great games I could think of. Alabama-Clemson, whatever game Clemson won was a good one.
Oh, yeah.
Alabama went up early in that game.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty early, but it was first quarter type early.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was a good one. I can, off the top of my head, I can't. Let's think. Mid game. Oh, I don't know. There's games. There's many games in college football where, and one example with NFL, it's like the end of game factor, like where, like the NFL game is the perfect example of this. I can remember right away. Is the AFC divisional round game last year between the Bills and the Chiefs. When Josh,
oh my God, yeah, that flipped eight times.
Seconds left, okay.
Yeah,
real time, just like quick, something happens, and in college football, especially with the clock, where the clock stops after the first down, you have no business tweeting that a game is over when there's more than 20 seconds left. So. That type of thing happens in college football a lot. Now, off the top of my head, I can't remember it, but because there's so many games like that.
Well, I was thinking somebody tagged something I tweeted last year at the Clemson NC State game because I said, you know, regardless of what's going to happen, NC State's going to cover because I think the spread was like Clemson by three or something like that. Now, NC State ended up winning outright, but within a second, somebody tags you and says, Clemson scores here and then pick six, Clemson covers. I'm like, no, stop. Just stop.
Yeah, that type of thing. Oh, yeah, with the betting. I don't usually do betting that much, but if that happens, definitely.
Yeah, it would have been. Yeah, we would have been all over Van Pelt as well on the Bad Beats segment. Oh, so. Yeah,
right, exactly. That's a perfect bad beat. Perfect bad beat. Yeah.
How did you get started in this? I know you were working on several different funny Twitter feeds.
Yeah.
And it took a while to hit on the right concept. What were some of the earlier ones that maybe didn't take off?
One was a spell check. One was a grammar check. One was a sarcastic, like I pretended to be this guy who didn't get sarcasm. I just reply like to the most sarcastic comment, obvious sarcastic comment, but like it was, I was serious. But none of them, even doing this, like none of those I expected to be anyone to follow it, to be big. I was just doing it to have fun. And I had been doing that for like 5 years. Like I had an account that was a parody of my friend. So like, and then I moved it to this. The next one was Freezing Cold Takes because I kept seeing sports media reposting their accurate predictions.
And
predatory messages. So I said to myself, someone should be the person to repost them. And quotes where some of them turned out to be wrong. And I became that person. And when I started it, my friend John, his name is John Zaslow. I grew up with him. He has a radio show. He was doing mornings in Miami on 790. And he's like, this is cool. I'm going to talk about it on my show. So he talked about it on the show. And then I got, that next day, I went from like 12 followers, my friends and family, to like 200.
Yeah. And then, I think I was following it within a week or two of it launching. Yeah.
And then a guy from Sacramento picked it up, and then he added like 300. So then I had a decent base of like 500. And then someone from New York, Michael Kay Show, did it. And then it got to 1,000. And then SportsIllustrated.com wrote about it. And then it was 25,000. Right after that. So that was how it happened. And then it became like everybody tagging me.
It is amazing. It was a necessary thing. It was something that didn't exist that needed to exist. And I think that's what makes it so great because like it doesn't bother me if you point out that I was wrong on the internet. Like, everything I write or say, it winds up on the internet, and I'm gonna be wrong. Like, just ask my wife. So, like, that doesn't bother me. But there I have colleagues that, like, it really gets under their skin when you point out they were wrong.
I can't even imagine the Slack chats. That crap that's talked about me in the Slack chats, and that's why I always figure that all the hatred toward you guys hate more now. What annoys you guys, and it comes back to me, but is you guys hate when people tag you about anything, even if it's not even a prediction. You just like say, this is going to – like, I'm excited for this game.
Yeah.
That's sad. No matter what happens in the game, you were excited for it.
I don't think I think some people, when they tag you, don't understand
the concept
what the criteria are. But the way I look at it is, if you have a fervent – passionate, bold take about something that you seem to actually believe, you're fair game. Now, my guy Dan Wilkins, like a gold mine for you, because and it's funny because when Skip Bayless left ESPN, I texted some executives at ESPN. I said, you need to hire Dan, because unlike the people on most of your shows, he actually believes every single thing he has a take about.
Dan gets a lot. I mean, that guy gets so much crap, but the thing about him, he does not tailor anything to anybody.
No.
He knows exactly how he feels, and he knows he's going to get killed, and he knows he's going to get 20 gazillion people writing under him how big of an asshole he is, and he'll still do it anyway. So he's very, very firm on what he believes and does not care. And I do believe that there's a lot of journalists who are worried about what people are going to write under their thing, and they don't say it anyway.
Yeah, you have to be able to let the comments go. And I've gotten better about that over the years. I still some of them hit wrong, but I have this conversation.
After I posted a lot of Kyler Murray ones, I found yours, and I didn't post it because I'd already used up my quota at that time.
Oh, what was it? He's always going to play baseball one?
You were very adamant that he would make more money in baseball. I mean,
he would make more money in baseball, but he liked football better.
Well, I don't think it's a tough sell now, because look, you have Kyler Murray. He's already made, like, with guaranteed money that he's going to make, he is going to make at least $260 or $220 million. How many first round picks in Major League Baseball? What percentage makes that over their career? I would say 1%.
But what percentage of football ones do?
Well, but he's already made it. So, like, when people say he's going to regret the decision or he would have made more in baseball, now the odds are completely against him.
Yeah, but when I said it, I was playing the math, because all you had to do is be relatively good. Like, if you were a top half of the league outfielder, you're going to make, just because the way MLB salary structures work and they don't have a salary cap, you're going to make an obscene amount of money.
Yeah, and you make $100 million.
Yeah. So...
Right, but even so, there's so many outfielders. So there's so many 10th round picks who barely made it up to the big league.
Well, and also in my case, I had just done a big story on Kyler at Oklahoma in November, and like talking to the people around him, they still had not turned to he's going to the NFL yet.
Right,
like it was he is going to play baseball, and so I was still kind of in that mindset of okay. His advice that he's getting is still go play baseball. And now I could tell from talking to him that he liked football better.
Right.
But it didn't feel like it was so much that he'd say, screw it. This may be a riskier proposition, but I'm going to do it.
Probably baseball was like secondary to him his whole life.
I would think so. And he's just really good at it. And it was a thing that you're really good at and people say you need to be doing. So
well, now the quarterback it's very futile to decide who's going to be a top quarterback pick before the season starts in college football. But the season starts in college football in September and the draft is in April. I mean, saying who's going to be the top draft quarterback is like futile because it changes on a drop of a dime, like Joe Burrow, and Cody Pickett. And like, none of those guys, they're all afterthoughts.
Nobody going into last season would have thought Kenny Pickett would have been a first round pick.
Yeah.
Joe Burrow was projected as a sixth round pick going into 2019.
Joe Burrow was a serviceable quarterback the previous season. Yeah. I mean, he was unspectacular.
But what's interesting, so you have a chapter in your book about Steve Young.
Yeah.
And what you dug into that I thought was fascinating is there were a lot of takes about Steve Young versus Joe Montana, which obviously that was going to create a debate. But when Steve Young, he plays in the USFL and plays well, USFL is about to fold, so he goes to the NFL and is with the Buccaneers, and they're terrible, and he's not good. But Bill Walsh is like, no, I know this guy's good. And Mike Holmgren was his quarterback's coach in college, and that was Bill Walsh's offensive coordinator. He's like, no, I know he's good. So, you know, a lot of it is situational, too.
Well, yeah, and in that circumstance, we'll never have a quarterback rivalry like that again. I mean, like,
no.
It's because there was no free agency. So, I mean, now if a backup quarterback has one great game, he's going to be getting a big contract somewhere else. You can't keep two amazing quarterbacks on your roster for more than a year in NFL. So that's not going to happen anymore. But, it's very situational. But it, just like back then, just like now, it's all recency stuff. Like, mm-hmm. Steve Young played great in one game where Joe Montana was hurt. He was hurt a lot, so Steve Young got to play good. And then people were talking about Young. But then Young, he had trouble sometimes closing out games, and that was Montana's specialty. So it was automatically assumed he can't close out any games. And it just went back and forth. But the one thing that stayed certain is that the city of San Francisco wanted Montana. The crazy thing about that was Young was coming off an MVP in 1992. Montana hadn't played in 2 years. He hadn't played, he hadn't started a game in 2 years because he was hurt. And Young played 1991 and 1992. And in 1992, he had an MVP season. He was the best quarterback in the NFL. The 49ers were the best team in the NFL in the regular season. And after all that, they lost to the Cowboys in the NFC Championship game where Jimmy Johnson said, how about them Cowboys in the locker room? But then after the season was over, Montana was 38. He was a broken man. He had absolutely no chance of playing a full season. And everybody in San Francisco wanted Montana. You had a young quarterback who was the best quarterback in the league, the best prospect in the league, who was doing amazing things, and they all wanted Montana. Who was broken.
Well, and that era produced some incredible hot takes because there weren't the debate shows, you know?
Right.
Kornheiser and Wilbon had not pioneered that concept yet. That didn't exist. You had the sports reporters on TV that were in some of the Northeast markets, but that was a more calm conversation. So this didn't exist. So where hot takes happened back then was down the left side of your sports section.
Yep.
800 word column. It was an incredible racket. Basically, you got paid to write three or four of these 800 word columns a week. And like if you were in a big city, you were paid really well. Like you were into the mid six figures if you were at the LA Times or one of the San Francisco papers or the New York papers. And it's just amazing to me the one-upsmanship with the takes. And that's probably my favorite part of your book is reading some of those like old Lupica takes.
Lupica. He didn't like Reggie White either. Well, he just was like, why does everyone want him so much?
Yeah. Why is this important? And it's like tell me you don't know anything about football without telling me you don't know anything about football.
Well, it was. But a great example of that was just before the hot take era. I mean, part of my take was around at the time, but there was no Skip Bayless first take yet and no Twitter. But it was Tom Coughlin. Tom Coughlin after 2006.
Oh, with the Giants,
Every columnist in New York, and you know New York, you have to make a stir. They all wrote their own fire Tom Coughlin column. And they really wanted Charlie Weiss. They thought Charlie, go do whatever you can to get Charlie.
He had almost beaten USC.
because Charlie Weiss was his peak when after the 2006 college season. And that type of thing happened. And then they got Tiki Barber talking. Tiki Barber went to NBC and he had to make a stir. So he had talked all sorts of crap about
I love that part of the book where Tiki Barber just admits, "Hey, I was starting my TV career, so I gave up. I spilled the tea on purpose."
The word couldn't have been worse for him. Tiki Barber just talking about how Coughlin just ruined his football. He didn't like playing on Coughlin. Manning couldn't do any. Couldn't lead. And his first year at NBC, he was covering the Super Bowl where the Giants won. Right the year after he left. And then on the Today Show, they hit him up. He was like, it was probably like 5 a.m. in Phoenix. And they like, "Congratulations, Tiki," as if like he was a part of it.
Oh, and it's just putting the knife in and twisting right there. We'll be right back after these words. And I think with the book, it is a great quick read. It's one of those, if you're on vacation, you take it out to the pool or the beach, you're going to finish it that day. I'm a person whose content is consumed on the toilet quite often. So I feel like I'm complimenting you here. So I hope you take it.
I say three chapters in one sesh.
It's a one poop at a time book. Yeah. It's great.
Yeah, three chapters in one sesh. Now the phone kind of ruined that. I was Sports Illustrated all the way. Back to the Sports Illustrated magazine.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, that was all.
Did you read it back to front like I did?
Yeah, well, no.
Rick Riley and then back.
I would just pick the articles of things because they had a lot of stuff I didn't care about, but they post about hockey or other stuff. I read some of the stuff like inside the NFL type things. Like
with yes.
And Rick Riley. Like that's yep. The thing I kind of did. But that was the great one. But phone ruined it all. I mean, it's a lost art.
Especially when I was working at the end of the time I was working for SI.com, they were embedding so many ads. Toilet reading got real tough on the phone.
Yeah.
So, but yes, this one you get in hardcover form and you can go, you know, one chapter at a time, one poop at a time. It might be a leisurely poop, but it is, it's perfect. Perfectly spaced out, timed out. And it is a franchise. Fred, you got to do a college football. You got to do a Major League Baseball.
Four volumes for college football, probably I could do. I don't even know what I could. I don't even know what to pick for college football.
Well, just think about this. So, I think back to after Mike Shula gets fired by Alabama. Remember how many people said you can't win at Alabama now?
Yep. I have a huge Jim Rome rant I wrote about a long time ago, where he was like, nobody wants to go coach there right before Saban was hired. Nobody wants to coach there. And Saban, I can imagine, had his eye on it for a long, long time during the Dolphins season. And he infamously said that press conference thing because he was just getting frustrated. But he had his eye on it for a long time. And because he was not enjoying himself in Miami. The reporters didn't know anything about that. And one of the things that I write at the end was a quote from somebody from the New York Daily News who was completely wrong about Belichick and admitted it, is that the journalists, like at the papers and stuff, are still mostly clueless about like the stuff that's actually going on the inside and what they're thinking. Like mm-hmm. The narrative about Belichick when he left the Jets after one day of coaching was that he was afraid. He didn't want to coach under follow Parcells. He's not a head coaching personality, all this stuff. But it actually was the opposite. He wanted control of the team.
Right. He didn't want to work for a bunch of idiots when he could go have control on his own and Bob Kraft was willing to give it to him.
Well, he not only wanted control, but Bill Parcells was around and was going to stay on.
Well, like
a ceremonial.
So you have the tuna looking over your shoulder.
Right. And you do not want to have someone look, not only do you want to have someone looking over your shoulder, but you don't want to have someone looking over your shoulder who knows what they're doing.
Yeah.
Because that's a recipe for disaster. Because he's just going to critique everything you say. So he wanted complete control. That was it. That was the whole thing. But all the narratives about him were completely unrelated to that. And it's just like it goes to show, like with Saban and the Alabama, everyone was talking about how nobody wanted to coach Alabama. But it's so obvious Saban wanted to coach Alabama for a long time.
He had a few schools on his wish list, like if they'd been open, but Alabama's one, Georgia was another one, but Georgia wasn't open. Mark Richt had just won the SEC. Yeah. Like that wasn't going to happen. So yeah, that was, you're exactly right. And I do think coverage has gotten better as time has gone on and
I think the relationships between like a lot of the journalists and the coaches have improved, like in terms of like they have great relationships with the coaches now. Sometimes you could tell which journalist has a great relationship with this coach, and you know when it's coming from that journalist, you're going to be seeing things that are positive about that person.
Oh yeah, yeah.
But I think that they know a lot more because of Twitter and social media, and there's so many things coming out at once that they want to control the narrative more. So they're becoming a lot more. The relationships between the journalist and the coach are a lot better.
Yeah, and I think the coaches have figured out, hey, they're going to psychoanalyze me anyway.
Yeah.
So I should at least have a few people that I put the real stuff out to get it out there,
exactly,
to get it into the ecosystem.
Yeah, so. Yeah. Journalism will always be that way, in a sense that like there's a ton of people in the mix trying to control the narrative, and there's a fight for it. But I think that they've realized that now Belichick doesn't care.
No,
the only one who doesn't care. Like, he's one of the few that just he does not care.
Like, and it doesn't matter because he knows what he's doing. And it's gonna work. Saban's very similar, although they will reach out and Saban will try to, you know, at least guide the talking points one direction or another.
College coach, you want to make sure that you're still because of recruiting.
Yes.
Really trying to make sure everything. But Belichick doesn't care. I mean, Tom Brady controls the Belichick Brady narrative because it's a one sided fight.
Yeah.
Belichick doesn't do anything.
And look, I might be, if I were him, I might feel the same way because I'm getting paid either way. Like,
yeah, but imagine how like the ego that he, imagine there's some part of him that doesn't have an ego.
He doesn't care what you think.
No coach besides him would ever allow, without a fight, people to think that one player did all his bidding throughout his entire career.
Yeah. You
know, no way.
It is amazing. And you know, you say you could do 4 volumes of college football. You could do 10 volumes of the NFL too. Like, I'm telling you, this is
a whole book on the Patriots.
This is a gold mine franchise that you've got here. So go out and get Freezing Cold Takes the NFL. And I will, Fred, I'm happy to act as your research assistant if you need me to throw you some college football stories through the years.
Well, I was a big college football fan growing up in the 90s. It always was my big sport. Like when I was 9 years old in the 90s, that was my decade
of college football.
And I was a huge Florida fan. It was before I went to Florida, but then I went, my father was a Florida alum and he trained me to be a Florida fan. So I was there watching the Danny Werfel days. You were on that team, right?
I was a tackling dummy. Yes.
Yeah. Those are my favorite teams. But I can remember the Miami. I can remember the articles coming out when Miami was playing Alabama in 92.
Oh, yeah, that, yeah. I want to see that game.
Jay Barker,
yep.
George Teague, Lamar Thomas play, which was a great play.
The greatest play that never counted.
It didn't count, but it did count because it allowed Miami had to decline the penalty. Miami had to accept the penalty.
Right.
So it was going to be a long game by Lamar Thomas. But since Teague stripped him, then it was an offsides penalty or something. And they had to accept the penalty. So it was really only a 5-yard game. So it kind of did count in that.
Yeah. But that Alabama team, John Curry, Derek Copeland.
Yeah.
John Copeland, Eric Curry, the bookend defensive ends. And they were loaded, but we just assumed that Miami and Gino Toretta. And so my mom was an Alabama grad. And so that was a huge night in our house because I bought into the whole, you know, white hat, black hat narrative back then. I think I would have been more of a Miami fan now because I like the teams that kind of buck the system more.
Yeah. Miami was the team back then who were And they can redo it now if they want to. I mean, they can make it, but now it's different because they're not going to be like universally loved by like, or universally that team who's in the country. Like they'll just be, there's so many different teams with narratives and everything. So it won't be as like that, but, and they can't be what they were like.
Well, and we also embrace that sort of behavior now, or a segment of us, like, you look at what we watch on TV, like Breaking Bad, the hero is a bad guy. Like it's one of those things that I think the world has changed a little bit, and those Miami teams would be viewed through a different lens now.
Right. Well, they're I mean, a guy like Mario Cristobal is going to allow them to be cocky, but he's not going to allow them to be like Miami from the.
No, he won't. And even though he was a player on those teams,
great, different. It'll be like a different thing. But, yeah, that's the team that's going to probably have the takes. Miami was playing BYU. I remember that game completely. It was the greatest game in BYU history. If anyone, even when they won the national, if anyone BYU person talks about the greatest game, it's almost likely is going to be when they beat Miami in Provo.
Well, and in the Penn State game where the Penn State beats them in the Fiesta Bowl for the national title.
Yeah, that one too. Mostly if they go on the road, they were a little bit more susceptible because they played a lot of their bowl games at home.
Yeah, but the Penn State one, if you want to find a narrative of these are the good guys and these are the bad guys, like it's classic 80s newspaper columnist shtick right there.
Yeah, Sandusky calling the plays too.
Yeah, exactly. So
he was masterful that game too.
Yes,
masterful.
Yes. And so I can't wait. So Volume 1 College Football. I don't know what your publishing schedule is. I don't know how your publisher feels or if they're ready to get to work, but I want this book as soon as possible, Fred.
I know. I mean, like, it'll be if it was what I want to do, 100% want to do, it would be college football. But I don't even know how much this is going to sell. I have known nothing about the stats. They don't give me the stats till Tuesday. I don't even know what's going on. So,
well,
if it sells,
I'm going to tell you right now. Go. We're going to have a link in the description.
Yeah.
On the podcast and the YouTube page to go buy the book. Go buy this book right now. However you want to consume it, you want hardcover, you want to just download it to your Kindle, however you want to do it, buy this book so that Fred will do a college football book.
Yeah. I even went to Barrett Salee. He was so happy he was in it. I sent it to him in this book. He had a lot I could use, but
Stuart Mandel's in this book, by the way. Stuart Mandel.
Oh, yeah. He loved it. He laughs about that one.
Expressing his excitement over Brandon Whedon and Trent Richardson in the same backfield. It looks like sarcasm now.
Yeah. He goes, that's pretty cool. Barrett Salee had ponder. He goes, what a pick. What a steal. Vikings.
Oh, you could do this over the draft. And you can always do this. Like,
yeah. You do a lot of draft stuff, but I kind of limit. I made the one chapter that is an extension of my feed where it just lists takes is the draft chapter. List takes, and that's it. But otherwise, it's all stories.
As much as I want a college football book, I actually think a draft book might do even better.
Now, a college football book it will do just fine. Something about the beginning of the season hype, like after the first week or first 2 weeks. There's no bigger narrative shifting sport than college football.
Oh, the Ohio State Virginia Tech game in 2014.
Given four narratives in a season, like completely opposite narratives by the time the season's over.
Yeah.
Yeah, that one is like the game, whatever game, like the preseason game, a team wins that game and looks like an amazing team. NC State versus Tennessee in 2012.
Oh, yeah. I think I was at that game.
Yeah, Tennessee killed him.
Yep.
He had all this great stuff happening. I think Cordell returned a touchdown, and the quarterback was throwing bombs to Hunter.
Yep.
And NC State and Tennessee, with the hype was huge. And they didn't understand they would have singularly one of the worst defenses. Besides Michigan with Rich Rodriguez and Florida last year. I think that defense was so bad, that Tennessee defense in 2012.
It's going to be there's going to be so much gold for you. But and I think, you know, we're seeing it now. We see it at the beginning of every season where everybody has to write there, this strength coach is the greatest strength coach, this new strength coach is the best of all time. Yeah. The last guy was a pansy, blah, 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 blah. And then all the legend building around whoever the new head coach is. And within 2 weeks, they're going to be fan bases ready to fire whoever it is that they just talked about.
I mean, like, I could do a whole chapter on Clemson fans in 2011.
Well,
I told a Clemson fan, I go, Dabo has some great, great, great material for Dabo. I go, but Clemson fans are equally as culpable.
Absolutely. Well, a Dabo chapter is something you need to do because you need when Dabo gets the interim job and everybody's like, who?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
When he's 2 years in and everybody's ready to fire him.
Oh God. Yeah. I think they went like 7-6 one of those years.
They did. They won the division and then they had a bad year offensively. So they wind up firing, he fires Billy Napier. Then he fires Kevin Steele, the two coordinators, and he brings in Chad Morris and he brings in Brent Venables. And that's really when everything took off, was in a little infusion of new ideas.
Dabo's always realized to me, and I guess he must have realized it pretty quickly, that he's best suitable as the guy who is running this program. It's like the CEO, and just leaves everything to his handsomely paid offensive and defensive coaches to do what they have to do. Yep. And he runs the program. That's why it'll be interesting now, because he got all these new coaches for them.
Yeah, but, that he's homegrown instead of bringing him from outside. So.
I could have a chapter on him. But the thing about college football is this. In recruiting, I don't use recruiting on my feed because it's all over the place. I'm not getting tagged to some guy saying that Iowa State was going to get this guy and Iowa got him.
Right.
I don't care. So, but with Brent Venables now as the coach, there was all this stuff talking about how Oklahoma is going to implode with Brent Venables. Mm-hmm. And he's not going to win there. And I get tagged by 1,000 Oklahoma fans, like when a 5-star recruit last week committed to them. Like, that's the validation.
Yeah.
It's that. So Brent Venables has been a great coach. He got this 1 5-star recruit. I'm like, come on. Like, you have to have the season. You have to play the whole season.
I'm just playing the numbers. Like, Oklahoma's always been good, with the exception of what, you know, the Howard Schnellenberger, John Blake, that little period there. Other than that, they've always been good. So I'm going to go with, they're probably going to be good.
That was when Dale Gundy was the quarterback and Justin Fuente was the quarterback.
Yeah. Yeah. It's going to be amazing. I cannot wait. And so,
that would be the one I would want to do the most. I mean, I don't even know. And your coaches would love to talk about that.
They would absolutely love it. So everybody go buy Freezing Cold Takes NFL, and we'll make Fred do Freezing Cold Takes College Football Volume 1. Please. I'm ready.
Please, you push for it. I would love to do it. Thanks a lot, Andy. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you, Fred. You provide me hours and hours and hours of entertainment every season. I'm so glad that I got to read the book and just keep it up.
Oh yeah. And hopefully I can write a lot more, because I enjoyed it. Everyone told me it's the worst thing in the world, writing a book. And I felt the exact opposite.
Well, I'm glad you liked it, because I want more of it. And I intend to give you plenty of material. So we'll keep working on that.
All right. Thanks, Andy.